Before we begin, just a quick note. If this conversation about alcohol, identity, and desire resonates, my new book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is out now. And if you want to go deeper, slowly, thoughtfully, and in ways that genuinely nourish you, I've opened the Thirsty For More Mindset Lab on Substack. You'll find links to both in the show notes. Right. Let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. Why, hello, and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink, where today I want to talk about something that took me a long time to find the words for, if I'm honest. Not because it's necessarily complicated, but, well, it confused me for quite a long time. And I've worked out since that it's the kind of thing that happens so gradually and so quietly that by the time you notice it, you've almost forgotten that there was anything different to notice. It doesn't announce itself. It doesn't feel like a problem. It just feels like life. So it's all a bit cryptic, isn't it? What I'm talking about is the way that alcohol can slowly shrink your world. Not in a dramatic, everything falls apart kind of way, but in a much subtler way than that. The way things that used to feel genuinely joyful start to feel a bit flat. The way the activities and places and habits you loved start to need a drink attached to them to feel worth doing. The way eventually some of them quietly drop away altogether and you don't even notice that they're gone. Now, I'm not putting this out there as a warning. I'm really not. If you've listened to this show for any length of time, you'll know that that's not what we do here. I'm putting it out there because it's one of the observations that I can so relate to myself. And I think that there are people out there listening who are going to live inside this experience right now. And you don't quite have the language for it. Who knows something feels a bit off, a bit smaller, a bit less than it used to be, but who haven't actually been able to put their finger on exactly what that is. So this episode is an attempt to put a finger on it. And I'll start, as I often do, with something personal. This is very much a personal story. Okay. So I used to live in London. I moved there around the age of 30. It was very exciting. It was a very, very exciting move for me. I was off to make a name for myself in advertising. I was going to be working in Soho, you know, the heart of London. And having gone down there age 30 as a single girl, I was going to have me the life of a single girl. I had a decent income and I had no one to answer to. Okay. I bought a flat in Hammersmith. And I bought a vintage scooter. And at the weekends, I would just go. I would crisscross the Thames bridges, drift through the food markets, stop at whatever street market happened to be open. The city felt huge. It felt inexhaustible. Every route had something in it, and I was absorbing it. The cityscape, the skyline, the river, the parks, the people. And that particular energy that London has on a Saturday morning, very distinct from the Monday to Friday. And I loved it. It was sheer aliveness. I was high on lifeness. That feeling that the world was large and full of things worth noticing and worth doing. And then at some point it stopped feeling that way. Not dramatically. The city was still there, the markets were still there, I was still there, but something about the quality of it all changed. It was fine. It was pleasant, even. But the things that used to feel like genuine exhilaration, that sense of possibilities being endless, became muted. And I was going through the same motions in the same places, but they were giving me less back. I assumed it was just familiarity, the inevitable outcome from doing something enough times that it stops feeling new and exciting. And I don't know, I chalked it up to adulthood in so much as I noticed it at all. But that wasn't what it was. That most certainly wasn't what it was. Over that period of time, my drinking was increasing. Frequency and volume. What had started as drinks after work a couple of nights a week when I moved to London had become drinks every night after work. And yes, often during work. A part of work. Hospitality, brainstorms down the pubs, you know, a few drinks before boarding a plane, which could be a couple of times a week because I was traveling a lot with work. What was actually happening has a name, and once you understand it, you can see it everywhere. Your brain has something like a pleasure baseline, a sense of normal and what normal feels like. Not a static thing, but a calibrated one, and it adjusts constantly to whatever input it's receiving. And one of the things it's very good at is optimizing, finding the most efficient route to dopamine. The highest reward for the least effort. This baseline, this pleasure baseline, is called the hedonic threshold. Okay? Now, alcohol is extraordinarily efficient in helping your brain to the quickest route to dopamine. It doesn't ask anything of you. It doesn't require you to be present or patient or curious or, you know, willing to sit with anything before it gives you anything back. It just delivers reliably and quickly every time. And your brain notices this. And what happens next isn't complicated per se, but it is worth stating really clearly. When your brain has a very efficient dopamine source available, it quietly deprioritizes the less efficient ones. Not immediately, not all at once, but gradually, incrementally in the background. The scooter ride still works, it's just that the brain has started to treat it as the slow route to dopamine. The market, the meal, the conversation, the city on a Saturday morning, they still work. They just start to feel like they're working harder, working more slowly than they used to. Like there's a dimmer switch that someone's been turning down very slowly for a very long time and you haven't been paying attention. This is what's happening when people say things just feel flat, when nothing seems to scratch the itch quite right, when the things that used to reliably restore you stop reliably restoring you and you're not sure why or what's happened. The world didn't get objectively worse. The floor moved. And here's the thing I find most striking about this and why I think it matters for the listeners of this show. The people that this happens to mostly don't think anything is wrong. There's no crisis, there's no obvious sign. They're likely functioning completely well. They're holding everything together, doing the work, showing up for their lives. They're not sitting in ruins. They're just a bit underwhelmed, a bit less lit up by the things that they used to be. Everything feels a bit meh. They find they're less absorbed in things that should be absorbing, less moved by things that should move them. And they chalk it up to tiredness or stress or just the general texture of a busy life. So I want to offer a different question, not what's wrong, but when did you last feel genuinely absorbed in something and was a drink involved? When did a simple pleasure last feel like enough on its own terms? Not good enough, but actually enough. I'm not asking that to catch you out. I'm asking because I didn't ask myself that question for a long, long time. I was too busy interpreting the flatness as information about the world, about how life inevitably just becomes more ordinary, when it was actually information about my nervous system and what I'd been feeding it. The world gets small, and because it happens so slowly, you forget it used to be bigger. And there's another dimension to this that I want to name separately because I think it operates differently and it's just as insidious, but it is different. What I've been describing so far is about sensation, the way that things stop feeling as vivid or as satisfying as enough. But there's a behavioral version of this, the same thing. It's not just that the world feels smaller, it's that it actually becomes smaller. So I'll give you an example. For a long time, I loved going to theatre, and I still went. But gradually, something shifted about why I was going. At some point, the drink in the interval became as much a part of the plan as the play itself. Then a bit further down the line, the drink after started to matter more than what we'd just watched. We'd leave and we'd go straight to the bar, to the pub, and the play was barely mentioned. And then, and this is the bit worth sitting with, there came a point where I'd find myself looking at what was on and just not quite feeling the pull. Theatre felt like a bit of an effort. A drink or going straight to the bar felt more straightforward, so I'd suggest that instead. An evening at the bar instead of an evening watching a play. I didn't frame it to myself as having stopped going to the theatre, it just happened. The theatre fell away. And this is what the narrowing looks like in practice. It starts with alcohol as a companion to the thing, a nice addition, the reward at the end. Then it becomes the point of the thing. Then eventually the thing becomes optional, because why do the whole activity when what you actually want is the drink? It can happen with anything. It might not be the theatre for you. It might be cinema or a sports club or a particular kind of social occasion you used to love. The specific thing matters less, really, than the pattern. And the pattern is the activity slowly gets reclassified from something you do to something you do if there's a drink involved to finally something you don't really bother with anymore. So the world doesn't just feel smaller. You've stopped visiting the parts of it that used to matter. And the quietly devastating thing about this is that it doesn't announce itself as loss. You don't feel yourself giving things up. You just gradually find that your life has less in it than it used to. You're not entirely sure when that happened or what you swapped it for. And if you want a sharper illustration of how far that threshold can move, consider this. When did a one-year-old's birthday party become a drinking occasion? I mean that as a genuine question, not a rhetorical one, because somewhere along the line, the Prosecco appeared at, you know, at the soft play or the one-year-old's birthday at a friend's house, and nobody questioned it. The parents are standing around watching a toddler destroy cake and, you know, destroy the ball pit. And someone somewhere is opening a bottle and it just feels normal, expected even. And if you're at that party and the bottle isn't there, or if you're not drinking, there's a low-level sense of something missing, right? Not boredom exactly, just a slight flatness, a sense that the occasion isn't quite complete. But when you think about that occasion and what it actually contains, you know, a small child, a celebration, pure, unmediated joy, cake, presents, excitement. These aren't experiences that should require enhancement. They are, on their own terms, genuinely joyful. But if they don't feel like enough without a drink involved, that is the hedonic threshold talking. That's your brain recalibrated to the point where even the uncomplicated stuff needs a boost to register properly. The theatre, well, you can argue the play was slow, you know, the drink made the evening, there's a defence available there. But a one-year-old's birthday party? I mean, I guess it can be an onslaught on the senses. But there's no version of an argument that holds that a one-year-old's birthday party needs a drink to enhance it. If that needs alcohol to feel sufficient, the floor has moved further than most people realise. For me, the moment that made it undeniable was quieter than any of that. It's an interesting one, this. I noticed that I'd stopped taking photos. Not a decision, not a conscious choice. I hadn't fallen out of love with photography, but the instinct had gone. I'd be somewhere doing something, and it simply wouldn't occur to me that this was a moment worth holding on to. And at some point, I did notice the absence of that instinct. I think my phone had broken or something like that, and I was trading my phone in, and I was trying to sort of upload to the cloud or something like that. And I realized that for months and months and months, I had just sort of not taken photos. My camera roll hadn't filled up with the normal amount of photos. I was scrolling back through my phone and I could see the gaps, whole stretches of time barely documented. Now, taking photos of stuff is how we say this matters. I want to remember this. And when you stop reaching for your phone, you're not just failing to document your life, you're revealing that fewer moments feel worth preserving, that less of it feels like something you'd want to look back at. The theatre falling away, well, you can miss that. The birthday feeling flat, okay, you can kind of rationalise that, but not wanting to remember your own life? That one was harder to explain away for me. That was one of my wake-up calls. I always say that when people say to me, you know, when did you realise that drink? That was one of my wake-up calls, not a crisis, just a quiet piece of evidence or the absence of my life caught on camera that I couldn't argue with. And the other thing I want to say, and I want to say it honestly because I think it's really important, is that the reverse is not simple. When you start drinking less or stop for a while, the first thing that often happens is everything does get flatter. Not more vivid immediately, flatter. The ride feels like less of anything. The Sunday can feel emptier. You're expecting some kind of flower opening moment and instead you feel vaguely grey and a bit restless. And you start to wonder if you've made the right decision to give up alcohol. You haven't. But there's a hard thing to hold on to when you're in it. What's happening is the floor is recalibrating, but it takes time. Your brain's sense of normal hasn't caught up yet. It's still expecting the efficient route to dopamine and finding it's not there. And it hasn't yet remembered how to properly value the slower moments. This is a real neurological process and it takes times, weeks sometimes, maybe longer. It doesn't announce when it's happening. You just gradually start to notice. Not a transformation, nothing dramatic, no massive fanfare, but just that things have a bit more texture again. A conversation that is genuinely belly laugh funny. A meal you can genuinely taste every nuance of. Piece of music that moves you like it hasn't for a while. The city for me in London, you know, eventually started to do something again. I'd moved out of London by the time I stopped drinking, but when I go back up to London now, I feel it. I feel it like I felt it when I first moved up there when I was 30. A lot more vivid. There's a lot more texture and a lot more colour to it than in those years before I left London as a hardened drinker. That is what recalibration looks like. Not a revelation, just the quiet return of ordinary things to something closer to their actual size. I think about that version of me on the scooter a lot. Not the version where the city felt like nothing, but the version before that, the one where the world felt inexhaustible and the possibilities felt endless. And a Saturday morning in London was genuinely enough. Now I have that again now, not because my life has become more interesting or the city has become more scenic, but because the baseline has moved back. I'm not telling you this as a before and after. I'm telling you because the size of your world is data. The degree to which ordinary things feel like enough, genuinely enough, not just fine, is telling you something real about what your nervous system has been trained to expect. So the question I want to leave you with isn't about drinking at all. It's just, what's the size of your world right now? And does it feel like it's been contracting without you even noticing? So I'm going to leave you to sit with that, not with judgment, but with the genuine curiosity that I always encourage on this podcast. I'm Anna Donaghy, and this has been the Big Drink Rethink. I will be back next week with another episode. Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. It really helps other people find the show. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find all of my resources and become part of the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebigdrinkrethink.com.